Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Harry Cooper from Shark Hunters about Hitler in Argentina. And this is part of the Hitler Escape trilogy as well. Very interesting material. A lot of things here to consider, of course, and we have much more to get into here in the second segment. Now, let's just kind of carry on the story a little bit, what you think happened here after the island from 47, I guess, and onwards, and how they got to Argentina and where they kind of set up shop there. I mean, again, there's speculations of colonies, there's speculation of certain areas being strictly, you know, ex-Nazi areas, basically. What have you found out here about what happened after the island part?
Oh, that, yeah, that's correct. There are areas like that. The island was merely in passing to where ships, boats, sailing, whatever, submarines, whatever, could pick up fresh water and food. The majority of the landings were, as you saw in the book, there's a chart in there, in the Caleta de los Loros, which means Parrot Cove, in the Golfo San Matias, St. Matthew's Gulf. This was a favorite stop-off for these ships and boats during the war to bring in spies, agents, money, equipment, etc. There was a guy in the German Navy, the Kriegsmarine, named Heinrich Garbers, Kapitän Leutnant, and he was awarded the Knight's Cross and the Ritterkreuz. And you wonder, who is this guy? What submarine did he command? What ship did he command? What battles was he in order to receive the Knight's Cross? Well, it turned out he was commander of a 90-ton sailing boat, yawl rigged, if you understand sailing, and he was able to go in and out of this port repeatedly during the war. And when, I think it was Bormann spoke to him in 1944, asked him if he could get back in carrying passengers, special passengers. And Garbers told him, sure, not a problem at all. And shortly thereafter, Gross Admiral Dönitz made the comment that they had found a Shangri-La for the Führer. And I believe he meant that little town of San Carlos de Bariloche, which is at the foothills of the Andes. I've been there twice. Beautiful little town. And I've been to the estate where Hitler lived twice. And, well, there's pictures of that in the book.
Yeah.
Now, when I was there the first time in 2008 with my two Argentine friends, we stopped for dinner at a very nice German-looking place. The whole town looks like it fell right out of Bavaria.
Well, exactly. That's what's so funny about this. You look at some of the architecture and it's like, all right. It's funny.
Yeah, you swear you're at the foothills of the Alps instead of the Andes. And so we went into this restaurant, and the owner met us at the door. He was an older man, about 75 or 80 years old, 6'2" maybe, and blue eyes, blonde hair. He didn't speak English. I don't speak Spanish. So he was trying to explain the menu to my friends in Spanish, and they were trying to tell me in English, and it wasn't working. So just on a hunch, I said, bitte mein Herr, ich möchte eine Speisekarte mit Englisch schreiben. Please, sir, I'd like an English menu.
Yeah.
Just instantly he comes back, mein Freund, haben Sie nicht? And we talked for about 2 minutes in German. And I don't know if he realized he had made the switch over. And so I said, du sprichst gut Deutsch, warum? You speak good German, why?
Yeah.
Oh, ich bin Schweizer. I'm Swiss. Yeah. So anyhow, during the evening, we were enjoying some really excellent Argentine beef. And he was playing a shuffle clavier. And his Argentine buddy was playing a guitar, and they were singing gaucho songs. So I went to him and asked if he would play the Matrosen Lied, you know, the song that the U-boaters would sing when they would leave port.
Mm-hmm.
No, sorry, don't know that. Okay, fine. So I'm back eating, and we were the only people in the restaurant at that time, and suddenly we hear, heute wollen wir ein Liedlein singen, and he went through the whole Matrosen Lied. Then he went through the whole Panzerlied, the song of the armored divisions. And he got finished, and I smiled, and I gave him thumbs up. He stood up, clicked his heels together, and stuck his right arm out in the air.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So And as you've seen in the book, pictures in the book, in that town, there used to be big celebrations on 20th of April, Hitler's birthday, with the swastika flag. And at the end of World War II, the Third Reich did not evaporate. It merely moved, in my opinion.
So what has come out of this then, if we get a little bit more into, I mean, you talk about some of Joseph Farrell's work as well in the book. You go into some of these interesting, very interesting angles here in terms of even the bell you mentioned. What, how far deep down, I guess, this rabbit hole have you gone?
Well, the bell, I'm not an expert on the bell. Joseph Farrell is far more than me, and there's a guy named Igor Witkowski from Poland, who I think is probably the world's expert on what the bell did, what it was, what it was made of, what it was supposed to do. However, one of my people who is extremely good at this research work informed me that the bell was taken out of that airfield. I can't remember the name of it, but the chart is in my book. And it was flown down to Uruguay. And there's also a chart in the book where it landed. It landed on a long highway that's 15 kilometers long on a straight stretch, and that a radio beacon had been put in a small woods nearby so that it had something to home in on. And it landed, and the aircraft was quickly taken apart and disposed of, and the bell allegedly went to the secret compound on that island by Bariloche. It's Huemel Island in Lake Nahuelwapi. I know my pronunciation is horrible, but that's the best I can do. And that's the island where Dr. Ronald Richter built a nuclear research laboratory in 1947, 2 years after the end of the war. German scientists had built a nuclear reactor, nuclear research building, laboratory there on this island, which was about, three or 400 meters from shore on this lake. And right there on shore is where Juan Perón built his mountain troop training school so he could keep an eye on the guys on the island. And at the far end of the lake, this is a huge lake, up a finger of that lake is where Hitler's estate was. It's called Inalco. It was built by Mercedes money at the end of the war. And that's where he lived until 1955, when the area was discovered as a tourist place. Great fishing in the summertime, great skiing in the winter. Hans Ulrich Rudel, the greatest pilot ever probably, and also Otto Skorzeny.
Yes, yes.
They were skiing in the Andes there near Bariloche. So what's wrong with skiing in the Alps by Munich where they live?
And you said you don't have that in the book, I guess, but there are photos allegedly of Otto Skorzeny skiing there, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And there was a little film, too, a friend of mine showed me down there in Argentina, but I couldn't get a copy of it.
Huh.
With Skorzeny.
Yeah.
Skorzeny was one tough guy.
Yeah, it's to say the least.
And he was allegedly down there to try to get some more money for what the Germans called Die Spinne, the spider, or as glorified or whatever in the movies, the Odessa. And Bormann had control of the money, and there was a guy there, Ludwig Freude, who was a director of the Banco Transatlantico Alemán, the German transatlantic bank. He was a director, and he's one of the 10 most wealthy men in Argentina. And he was also helping funnel money in from other sources to Bormann, to Perón, and Skorzeny wanted some of it for the escape route. And my guess is he probably got it.
Now, what do you think happened to, if this was more or less larger areas where you had, well, let me ask you this first, actually. How many do you think, speculative here, of course, but how many Germans and maybe civilians and let's say their wives, potentially even children, etc., managed to get out? And how many areas in Argentina and other places, potentially in South America, have been colonies of sort? How many people are we talking about overall?
Thousands and thousands. There was a Croatian guy, the Croatian strongman, a guy named Ante Pavlik, who went to Buenos Aires. He was a bricklayer until somebody introduced him to Juan Perón. Then he suddenly had big contracting companies, and he built some of the huge buildings that are still in Buenos Aires. And he helped get about 35,000 Croatians into Argentina. So if he could get 35,000 Croatians, how many Germans did he get in there?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of them. And we were that now. That was in Bariloche. I was telling you about the fellow that ran the restaurant. We were a year later. We were up in Cordoba province, and I was going to. Now, incidentally, in this town, Villa General Belgrano. That's everything there is in German. We stayed in the Hotel Bavaria. We ate in the Munich restaurant in Argentina. And I was going to buy some souvenirs for my wife and children. And, of course, the shopkeeper didn't speak English. I don't speak Spanish. So I thought I'd try my German on him. Well, he didn't speak that either. But, he got all excited. Oh, momentito, por favor, señor. Momentito. Please wait a minute, sir. He gets on the phone. He's babbling away in Spanish. And about 2 or 3 minutes later, here comes this good-looking young German kid, about 25 years old or so, tall. Blue eyes, blonde hair, and so we spoke in German. His grandfather had been a lieutenant general, Generalleutnant, in the SS with the Panzermeier. So it's not very far away.
Right.
Any place you go, if you can speak German down there in Argentina, you'll find somebody to talk to.
How many spots like this would you estimate that there is in this regard? Because it seems to be kind of, I guess, a little bit scattered here and there. And would you say that this have they blended into the local populations, or have they kind of remained their own homogenous centers within the country? How has this worked out, you think?
Well, yeah, the answer is both scenarios are possible. When the crew of the Graf Spee, the panzer ship Graf Spee, was interned in Buenos Aires. They were escaping in wholesale numbers, so to get back to Germany. And so most of the sailors were shipped up to this town of Villa General Belgrano, and they settled there, and they married local girls, and they stayed there until they died, for the most of them. When we were there in 2010, we spent an afternoon with the last remaining German crewman from the Graf Spee, him and his wife. She was from there. But there are other areas where they are strictly German enclaves. The most glaring example probably is Colonia Dignidad.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which the name has been changed now to Villa Bavaria or something like that. But that place, prior to having Schaefer, the leader there, having him arrested and jailed, whether real charges or trumped up, who knows. But that kind of broke the back, and after that, then they changed the name to Villa Bavaria, and it's no longer, from what I understand, it's no longer a closed enclave. They were, well armed. And allegedly, when Pinochet was trying to overthrow Allende, some of Allende's supporters, thousands of Allende supporters, were brought into Colonia Dignidad, but they never saw him coming out.
Right.
When we were watching a celebration parade or something on television, my wife and I, and 1990 it was, and there was Pinochet reviewing his troops. The camera was positioned behind Pinochet and off to his right a little bit, so you could see him in the left side of the film, and he was saluting, and his troops were marching past from the left to the right. And I told my wife that, you know, if these uniforms were black, you'd swear you were in Munich in 1936, because there's the same uniforms as the SS wore.
Jeez.
And my wife pointed out, look at Pinochet's cuff. He had a huge, big, ornate cuff with German oak leaves all around it, and right in the middle of his cuff was the big silver SS, Sigrun SS. I saw it. So
wow.
The influence was everywhere.
Well, exactly. I mean, they've talked about that, the Pinochet, you know, his time, and then of course you had disappearances of prisoners from Chile there as well. And what would you say to, you know, I was reading about Villa Bavaria as well, or Colonia Dignidad the other day. They were talking about how basically there's like a continuation of you know, Nazi activities in these locations. Is that, have they just picked up here, like nothing has ended, and they're just, you know, doing the same thing as it did in Germany, but they're in Argentina now and other places in South America? Or how do you view this?
I'm not an expert on that. I've never been there. I will be there this coming January, which, as you know, is the height of summer down there. But all I know about it is what I read about it. And it is definitely off limits. It was. Now I understand it's not so restricted. And from photos I've been able to get of the old days when it was Colonia Dignidad, everything was neat, well-ordered, clean. The children went to school there. They learned the old German ways. But it was founded, I understand, by 300 SS soldiers and their families. And they maintained a pretty solid tradition of the way it had been in Bavaria. So that's what I have read.
Yeah.
I've not been there.
Right. Not speaking about this location specifically then, but I guess all of them, or generally what you know about the knowledge. Do you think that the, you know, if they have children and they have children, etc., is there any idea that they're kind of passing down what has happened, the history to their children and everything?
I can't say for sure, but my guess is it probably did. But I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
When we were there in 2010, up in Cordoba province, we were driving from La Falda to the little town of Miramar, which is out in the middle of nowhere. But there's a very important hotel. The ruins of a hotel are there. And as we were driving along, I mean, you're driving through the Pampas. It's flat, and there's not a darn thing to look at except maybe a couple of cows here and there. And it started to rain, and the windshield wipers on the rental car needed to be replaced. So we found a wide spot in the road that had a huge big building, and it was a restaurant, it was an auto repair shop, it was a souvenir shop, and all sorts of things. And upstairs was living quarters for the people who lived there. So we stopped to buy wiper blades and to get something to eat. And all of a sudden we saw these half a dozen little kids running around, 5 years old, 6 years old, light skin, blue eyes, blonde hair, and their blue-eyed, blonde-haired mother was chasing them. And so we're thinking, well, something's a little not correct out here.
Yeah.
Yeah, we never found it any further.
Interesting. Well, there's a lot of, obviously, conspiracies flying around about this, you know, this kind of research and stuff like that as well. I wanted to get your take on some of those claims there that, for example, that's been a powerful industry of, you know, knowledge and research has continued. Not only then, I'm talking about the U.S. them picking up on it, basically turning the German rocket knowledge into the space program and all that. We have that, but people take it further, that there is more going on, that there is even, you know, the potentiality of the, you know, the Bell. They've actually developed more or less flying saucer technology, etc., that they've actually managed to, in some way, even set up their own space program. What do you make of those ideas, Harry?
I'm not an expert on that. There's a lot to be said on either side of the flying saucer issue, but the Bell, the technology, the nuclear weapons, the rockets, there's just no disputing that. The first head of NASA was a German rocket scientist, Dr. Debuse, and one of our members, Clark McClelland, had been 35 years with NASA, and some years ago, he was in the office of Dr. Debuse, and he was introduced to two German scientists. One was Dr. Kammler. So we're trying to, I don't know if you know anything about Hans Kammler, but we're trying to follow that trail. He was the third most powerful guy in the Reich. He was in charge of all the secret projects, and his headquarters was the Skoda Works in, Prague. And at the end of the war, he just evaporated. He disappeared without any trace at all. According to one story, he walked into the woods and shot himself so that the Allies couldn't make him divulge secrets. Or another story was that he was marched into the woods by his SS guards, and they shot him dead, and then they shot their own major dead so he wouldn't talk. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Or a third scenario was that he came over to the United States with paperclip.
Right.
We don't know.
Yeah.
But our member Clark McClelland, who's an honest man, I had lunch with him a few months ago. He saw him. He met him. And he was also introduced to a fella by the name of Dr. Green, or Mr. Green, I can't remember which. I don't know if this is the same Mr. Green, but that's the code name that Heinrich Mueller was using when he came to the United States, Gestapo Mueller.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's not an area where I'm an expert in.
Right, yeah. Well, there's a lot of other interesting aspects in the book as well, and before we carry on, talk a little more about that. So what do you think about the interests of the Nazis, that's something that has continued? Again, another set of ideas here is that they basically built up their, not military campaigns, but they've been achieving or trying to build up a presence again, if you will. I mean, some people say that the Third Reich basically went underground, and some speculate that they've been working to take over the EU economically or undermine other countries economically. I know you don't deal specifically a lot with that in the book, but what do you make of some of those ideas after the research you've done?
Well, I don't know if it's the old Nazi party, to use that term, or somebody else, but and again, I'm not an expert on this, but it appeared to me that the EU was only put together by the banking industry over there, primarily the German banks, to compete against the U.S. banks for world currency. And I don't know how the EU has managed to stay in existence this long. I have many, many friends in Germany and Austria. Not one of them likes the EU. Everyone is against the EU,
yeah,
but they're stuck with it.
I know.
They hate the euro. They hate the EU. And I had a good friend who won an election in Austria, and a much bigger election than people thought. This was September of 2008. And he had arranged a meeting between himself and the leader of the other right-wing party, and he announced that they were going to take Austria out of the EU, which would have caused a domino effect, I think. And he said that he was going to get rid of the euro, and he was going to kick out all the so-called asylum seekers who are, he said, were nothing but freeloaders.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wasn't even a month after he won the election that he had a one-car crash and killed him.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I remember that.
That was Jörg Haider.
Yep, that's right. The enemies of the new United States of Europe, as it were. Yeah.
More or less, yeah.
Yeah, very interesting.
And if anybody rocks the boat too much, you're going to have an accident.
Well, I would figure then that if Nazis were really in charge of the European Union, either financially or ideologically or whatnot, why would they run the Europe, Europe that they're doing now, then, if that's the case. I just don't see, you know, credibility in that specific angle here. Why would people like Jörg Haidl be taken out if that was the case, right?
Well, yeah, but I don't know if it's the Nazis or just who's running it, but somebody's running it. And Haider yep. was definitely going to cause them some problems. He was going to pull Austria. I was in Klagenfurt when the election was going on, and all the big posters and signs were in German, of course. They were saying, Austria for the Austrians. And he was saying in his campaign he was going to kick out all the exotic people, as he called them. And there are some towns there, like Hallein, for instance, is a very important town to their heritage. It's 60% Muslim now.
Sure, yeah, I know.
So he was going to clear all that stuff out, and he had on his posters, he had pictures of pretty little Austrian boys and girls going to school like it was back in the 30s. And there are so many things wrong with that so-called car accident, but that's another whole story.
Yeah, no, it is. But it's true. We've been covering that in a few programs now with a couple of guests as well, in terms of the changing landscape of Europe and how things are being taken over and how certain areas are basically being ethnically cleansed in that regard, and more people. I mean, just look at London. I think 600,000 white Britons have left London in the last 10 years, and they're going to other areas of the country. So they're no longer a majority in their own capital. That's pretty amazing, you know?
Yeah, and we've got many, many members in Britain, and we're always getting jokes about how, there's a saboteur going to blow up, and they think they're going to kill everybody in Nottingham, and that's at least six Englishmen going to get killed, you know, if they kill everybody in Nottingham, because six of them are Englishmen, the rest are others. And
exactly.
You're right, if you've ever gone through the airports over there, I've changed planes sometimes in Heathrow and whatever the other one is, I can't remember the other one, but good God, you know, it's not very many regular English people in there.
Yeah, I mean, okay, the airport, you can understand. There's a lot of people traveling in that, but that continues even when you leave the airport and you go out into London.
That's
the issue there, you know. Yeah, for sure. Now, tell us a little bit about Schwabenland as well. Schwabenland, you talked about that's, of course, one of the boats, the ships that was part of this as well, but we have the interesting expedition to Neuschwabenland in Antarctica. This is, of course, one of the reasons why Argentina potentially was a strategic place as well, that there were expeditions done kind of back and forth between Argentina and Antarctica at that time. You have some photos of that in the book as well. Touch a little bit upon that. What do you know about this expedition?
Right. 1939, that was the mapping expedition, and the Schwabenland was a catapult ship. It would launch seaplanes, which would fly over Neuschwabenland and then come back and land on the water and be picked up. They were Dornier, I forget the number, but they called them the Dornier Whale. And they would fly along the border of Neuschwabenland, and every kilometer they would drop out what they call a spear, which was a stainless steel shaft about 5'6". I don't know what that equates in meters, but on the top was flattened, and it had a swastika on it every 1 meter, but every tenth kilometer, I'm sorry, every 1 kilometer. And then every tenth kilometer, they would drop a spear that was 2 meters, and it had a metal swastika flag on it, and they were going around marking the borders. We have photos of them. We have photos of the German expedition on the ground in Argentina, Antarctica, sorry. Got photos of these spears they were dropping, photos of their base, their little port, which I think are in the book. And now all of a sudden it's evaporated. And, of course, Admiral Byrd went down there with Operation High Jump, and why he needed 5,000 people for a so-called mapping expedition in, 1954, I think it was, or something like that. And they even had a submarine there what good is a submarine when you're mapping a continent?
Right, yeah.
So, and I understand it's very difficult to get permission to go there. I would like to go there with an expedition, but the cost is just absolutely incredible. An old friend of mine, a guy named Charlie Walgreens, there's a big chain of drugstores in the United States,
sure.
Walgreens drugstores.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Charlie and I belong to the Adventurers Club in Chicago. And some years ago, when he was going to celebrate his 90th birthday, he and a bunch of his friends chartered a C-130 to fly them down, land at the South Pole. They got out, and they opened a bunch of bottles of champagne. They drank a toast. They had a couple of pieces of birthday cake, got back on the plane, and came home. It cost them $30,000 per man just to go down there.
Wow.
For an hour.
Yeah.
So what would it cost for a month-long expedition? A ton of money.
Yeah.
And we don't have any money. I don't make any money from shark hunters at all. The sale of the book, I don't take a salary or anything. So we don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Well, and despite that, you guys have been in a lot of places, and you say trips all the time, you know, from all over Europe and South America. And it's amazing what you do. And you take photos a lot of the places and video and things like that as well, right? You have a lot of that on the website, correct?
That's correct, yep.
Very interesting stuff. What are some of the other, like, really interesting places that you visit? I think you were at the Wolf's Lair, the Wolf Schanze as well, correct?
That's correct. Every so often we have a tour going from Berlin east as far as Warsaw, and we stop at the Wolf Schanze. And when we stay there, we actually stay overnight in the SS officer's barracks. It's still standing, and we sleep in the same barracks, in the same beds that the SS officers used to stay in.
Really? That's amazing that's
yeah.
empty. As no one is like, I mean, I don't know what they should do. I mean, it's turn it into a museum or something. I mean, I don't know.
Well,
but
that's already been done. It's under private ownership.
Oh,
now
it is? Okay.
Guy, yeah. yeah.
Okay.
Guy owned, I don't know who it is or how to get in touch with him. We have a man in Berlin that takes care of all that. And the food is somewhat lacking. we got there last time, and all we had was cabbage soup. And
oh boy!
So I missed my dinner that evening. but we go all through, and the bunkers are all blown up because after the defeat of Germany, the Soviet Union took them over, and as they finally left, when the Soviet Union was destroyed. They destroyed all these bunkers. They blew them all up. So Hitler's bunker is no longer standing, but there's gigantic, huge pieces of concrete. You know, these things are like 10 meters thick, steel-reinforced concrete walls and ceilings, roofs that are 10 meters thick. So you can't take it home with you, but they blew them up to where they all fell apart.
Right.
But the wooden buildings are still standing, except for the one where when Stauffenberg put the bomb under the map table. That one's blown out. So we go there, we visit that. There's also a bunker complex only about 10 kilometers away in the forest that nobody even knew about. The Russians left without blowing it up. And von Manstein's headquarters was there. And all the bunkers are still there, intact. And we go through that. We go through various other historic places. But the Wolf Schanze, probably the most famous because that's... Oh, and we were at the abandoned train station where you see the pictures of Hitler and Goering and the Honors Guard standing there waiting for Mussolini to come in on the train.
Mm-hmm.
We were there, and there's a bunker underneath that. We've been in that. Also, the airfield where von Stauffenberg went after the bomb went off, and he thought Hitler was dead, and he flew back to Berlin, told everybody, Hitler's dead, we're in charge. And his co-conspirator, the police general, says, no, Hitler ain't dead, and no, we're not in charge. And then they shot him so that he couldn't talk to anybody.
Hmm.
It's also the same airfield where Todt, from the organization Todt, he came back from the Russian front, and apparently he was very loudly chastising Hitler, telling him he was a fool and he's lost the war, etc. So the next day, Todt was going to fly back to Berlin, And Speer was supposed to fly with him, Albert Speer. And somebody told Speer, you look really tired. You ought to wait one more day and go back tomorrow. Okay, fine. So Todd's plane took off, got about 300 meters in the air, and just suddenly exploded.
Hmm. Wow.
Doggone inconvenient explosion.
Right, yeah, exactly. Lots of that going on.
Yeah, just like Hyder's one car accident.
Yeah, exactly. Now, tell us what you think happened to Martin Bormann and some of his objectives and how they were carried on, that he's been kind of seen as one of the main node point in all this network that went over to South America. You mentioned that he had large financial assets to him because he seemed to have been giving both to Perón and some of the other leaders as well, their money, etc. If there was a huge financial resource and everything there, what has happened to that? Is this being continued, maintained in some way today? What's your speculation about this?
Speculation is correct, but I think what it was, he used his share of the money to get into the business world down there, and I think they've got German domination behind the scenes. And when Evita came over to Europe in 1947 during that Rainbow Tour, she also moved a lot of the money that was in the secret Swiss bank accounts, moved it out of the joint account jointly held by Bormann and Perón, and moved it into Perón's own account. Then most people are unaware, and I'm one of them, I was not aware, in Latin America, when important people die, they're not embalmed like normal people and buried in the ground. They're treated with a taxidermist, like a deer you might shoot in the woods, and kept in a crypt. And in 1987, somebody broke into Perón's crypt and chopped off his hands. Now, why would anybody want to steal Perón's hands? Well, we guess maybe fingerprints were necessary to get into secret bank accounts.
Huh.
I can't think of any other reason somebody would take his hands. Why would anybody want the hands of Juan Perón as a souvenir?
How could it do that if he was dead, right? If the accounts had been transferred in some way, if he's dying, right, or dead?
Maybe they were transferred. Maybe they weren't transferred.
Right. Hmm.
Also, we have a photo of his last wife, Isabelita, standing there with her right arm stretched out in the old so-called Nazi salute. And this was in July of 1974.
Hmm.
So we have found Isabelita, and I have sent her many letters asking her if I can sit down and speak with her, but she has not replied to my letters. So.
Right, yeah.
And she's in a very, very secure area, so I don't think I can walk up and knock on the door.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Don Angel, the Alcazar de la Velasco, he died in 1985, I believe, correct?
No, not 1985. That's part of his number. You see, 158-1985.
Yeah.
158 is his membership number. 1985 is the year he joined Shark Hunters.
He
died in the 90s. Well, I'd be a very old man because my number is 1-1983. That means I lived 1983 years. Even
right.
Methuselah didn't get that done.
Yeah, right. I was wondering about that. I was like, 158. Okay, I guess that's just an error, and he died in 1958, but 85, I mean. But okay, thank you for clarifying that. Nonetheless.
That's when he joined. He died in the 90s.
Right, okay, 90s. That's still some time ago. Has there been another whistleblower, insider speaking out like him, or was he the money melon in this aspect?
The money melon, that's an interesting term. No, he's the only one we've got so far. And you know, the clock is ticking.
Yeah.
These old guys are almost all of them are gone. And of course, I got some grief out of some goofy woman here in the United States who runs a website, Carolyn Yeager. She poo-pooed all this by saying, oh, yeah, all of Cooper's sources are dead, so we can't see if Cooper is telling the truth. Well, they're not all dead. Most of them are, and it's not my fault. I'd love for them to still be alive, but, you know, the clock keeps ticking.
Yeah, well, exactly. Is there, I mean, obviously there's a lot of things missing in the picture. There's so much things that are unknown, and in this regard, you're independent researcher. You're relying on a lot of people coming to you and things that you guys pull together and what you find when you're out and about, of course, but Is there any one area where you wish that there was like a lot more information so that you could find out what really happened about this, that, or the other?
Yeah, but I don't know what that source would be. I'd love to find movies of Hitler having a barbecue in his backyard in 1960, but that's not going to exist. Or him having a drink with Scorsini on the patio there at Inalco in 1955. They're not going to find that. There are, I got to believe, there are photos somewhere. But where are they?
Yeah.
This lady, Catalina Gamarro, the waitress that waited on Hitler and Eva Braun in 1949 at a hotel up in Cordova province. That's in the book also.
Yeah.
And the interview that one of my people had with her when she talked about serving Hitler and Eva Braun, not in the hotel, but in the annex, which incidentally is where I stayed when I was there a few months ago. But she's dead. There's a guy who was a laborer working for this Antipavlik guy I was telling you about, who was a big construction guy. And he said that he saw Hitler talking to Antipavlik three separate times in the town of Mar del Plata, which is a big resort town south of Buenos Aires, and it's also home port for part of the Argentine Navy. And he's still alive. He doesn't want to talk to us, but one of our people interviewed him and put it on tape a couple of years ago, and he told all about how he saw Hitler speaking with Antipavlik in Mar del Plata.
Right.
We're trying to change his mind to talk to us too, but
yeah.
You know, he's afraid of something. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Is there still... That would mean that someone is still just actively trying to keep the lid on this. Who would you suspect that is? Would that be someone in Argentinian government? Is there something within the network of the old Nazis still that's active and trying to silence people? Or what do you think?
My guess would be it's the old German network. The Argentine government has changed over so many times. Who knows? But the last president they had, his last name was Kirchner, which is not a very Hispanic name.
Yeah.
And he passed away in office. He was rather elderly, and he died of a heart attack. But his wife now is the president. She is a Latin, but she's got his last name, Kirchner. A beautiful woman, too.
Now, tell me about... You published one of the photos there. I've seen that before as well, of... alleged Hitler being dead. I guess in the 1960s, he kind of has a scarf over half his face. You can barely see his eyes, basically. What? Tell us more about that photo.
Well, that photo came from one of our agents in South America, in Argentina, and he claims that it is Hitler as an old man taking a nap in the sunshine with the bandana over his face, covering part of his face. You can still see the cheekbone, the ears, the mouth. You can't mistake it.
You think it's authentic, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And if I remember the book correctly, I've got that picture next to Hitler as a man in his 40s, 50s, whatever.
Yeah.
And the shape of the mouth, the ears, cheekbones, everything's exactly the same.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Now, the other place, the main house, the complex. Let's see, I was gonna find her again. Exactly where that was. The big, log cabin style home, right? Yeah.
Right. That's in Alco, and it's at the end of a long finger of this lake, Nahuelhuapi, and you can only get to it by water. And if you come by one direction, you have to pass this tall watchtower. There's photos of that in the book. Or if you come from the other direction, you have to pass a small bunker, which was blown up in 1960 as a military exercise. Either way, no matter which way you came from, somebody was going to see you and notify the house that you were on your way. And when we went there in 2009, I had a small group with me, and we rented two small cabin cruisers to take my group to the house. And we beached the boats on the sand. We got out and we had to walk about, 60 meters, 70 meters to the house across the lawn. And as we were walking, our boat captain, who was about 60 years old, comes walking along beside me, goose-stepping with his right arm out up in the air. And he had his other finger under his nose like a little mustache. Caught me by surprise. I said, "What in the hell are you doing?" And he said, "I know who lived here." And he stuck his right arm up again. And I said, "Yeah, how do you know that?" And he said, "I lived here because my father was the caretaker of this property, and I grew up here." And with that, he put his right arm out in the air again, and he says, "And I know who lived here." And he went goose-stepping back to his boat.
Really?
Yeah.
Jeez.
So the people there, they all knew. Erich Priebke, I told you about him. He got outed by Sam Donaldson, and he lived out his life in Rome in under house arrest in an apartment, although it wasn't much arrest. He could go to the store, etc. I had dinner with his son in 2009,
mm-hmm.
and he never did say anything about Hitler, but he said if it wasn't for the Nazis here, this town wouldn't exist.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
Very intelligent man. He was sitting at the head of the table. I was sitting around on his right. Our translator was on my right, and on his left across the table from me were two hardcore right-wing Germans. He was carrying on a conversation with the Germans in German, a conversation with me in English, and a conversation with our translator in Spanish, all at the same time. I have trouble maintaining my thought just in English.
Right. All right. Now, well, this is a very interesting story. We've touched upon this one in a couple of other shows in the past. It's something that keeps coming up because there's just so much inconsistencies in the history that we're being told, and all the trails and leads and everything else. What's next here now for you, Harry? And the quest continues, of course. You said you have new travels coming up here later this year, correct?
Absolutely. We've got a couple of guys in Argentina still working. One of them just sent back photos of the remains of the Lauzon factory way down south in, I think, Patagonia. Lauzon was a huge company all through South America, Lauzon Wool Company. They had stores in every little town, and they would buy wool from the ranchers, etc. It was also the conduit for the German agents in the war. And they had this one factory down way south at Patagonia that would melt down seals and whales and get the oil out of them, which I guess is good lubricating oil for heavy machinery. And we keep getting reports that some U-boats would stop down there and pick up supplies from this Lauzon place, and the ruins of the factory are still there. So we're going to go see that. There's also in Mendoza province, the ruins of a hotel or lodge or whatever it was, where Perón used to meet with German agents in the late 30s and early 40s. So we're going to go there and interview people also. There are some other places we need to go visit and interview people and look for any kind of evidence. We go there with metal detectors, beeping around, wondering if we're, you know, maybe find an old Reichsmark or something in the sand. That would tell us a lot. And there are other things we're looking at that we can't talk about either.
All right. Okay. Well, it would be great to have you back at some point and continue talking more about some of these things. I also want to mention, by the way, you have, over 100 DVDs that you have available on the website as well for people on specific
yes.
subjects and interviews, etc., correct?
That's correct. Some are interviews. Some are tours, and the interesting thing, as I say, Eingang verboten means there's something here that Harry needs to look at. So I have been known to go around signs that say, "No Pessar, Eingang verboten," etc. And a few times when police have started yelling at me in German, Of course, then I suddenly can't speak German anymore. I speak in my best down yonder hillbilly. Well, calm down there, Sheriff. I know you're trying to tell me something important, but I don't know what it is y'all are telling me. Then about all they can say is, get the hell out of here.
Right.
I say, well, wait a minute. Ain't this here the Raper Bond? I've been looking for the Raper Bond. So.
That's funny.
As long as we go into places like that, we never touch anything. We never take anything. We never break anything. We just take films.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's very interesting work. And why don't we leave again here with you giving us the website and, of course, how people can get copy of the book, Hitler in Argentina. And, of course, you know, if they want to read more about all the evidence and research that you have collected here.
Excellent. The website is sharkhunters.com. And when you go on there, you can click on the part that says previous tours, and you can see all our previous tours, some of them with people in areas anybody can go to. Others are expeditions. Click on books, and you can see where to order Hitler in Argentina or any of the other books we have. If you're in the U.S., if you're not in the U.S., you really got to go to Amazon because our postal system here is not the best there is. And if you'd like a free copy of our electronic monthly magazine, just send me an email, sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and say you heard me on the Red Eyes program and you'd like a copy of the magazine. Bingo, it's right on your computer.
Well, great. Thank you for that. sharkhunters@earthlink.net and, of course, sharkhunters.com. That's the main website. Well, this has been very interesting. Thank you for your time today, Harry Cooper. We appreciate you coming on and talking with us about your travels and your research and work.
My pleasure, Henrik.
Thank you for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back with Don Park and then Frank Salter in just a few days. After this, we have Joseph P. Farrell and also Joseph Atville coming up. A big thanks, as always, to all our members. If you're either a new member or a dedicated listener who's been with us for some time, we appreciate all of you, and our hat goes off to you for making this possible and for helping us to expand and grow in our productions. I wish you have a great rest of your day or evening, wherever you are, and we'll speak to you in just a few days. Take good care. We'll see you soon.